Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Hey fellas, I'm talking to you, you guys know who I'm talking to. Those of you who go out and stay out all night and have the night, but let me tell you something, the sisters are not going for that no more, because we realize two things, that you aren't doing anything for us.
Hello, this is the Gist of Freedom you're listening to, and I'm your host tonight, Leslie Gist. We have Solomon Northup's direct descendant, Irene J. Host, on the line tonight, and let's see if she's here. Are you here, Irene? Irene? Hello, Irene, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I can hear you loud and clear.
Thank you.
Great. We have you on the show. We had you on the show once before. It was right after the movie. And tonight you're on because you want to ask our audience to help promote a special project or sentiment that you have. But before we delve into that topic, let's first introduce you and tell the audience who you are, how you're connected to Solomon Northup, and we'll start from there.
Okay. My name is Irene Northup Zahos. I am for Solomon. I am his great-great-granddaughter. I'm one of three, I believe. And I'm related to him through his son, Alonzo. Alonzo had 9 children, and one of those happened to be my grandfather, whose name was John Henry Northrup. He had a moniker by the name of Zip because he was a semi-pro and then professional Negro League baseball player. But Zip went on to marry a white woman. That was his second marriage. And from that marriage is where my family tree branches out from. Actually, his son, John, is my father.
You appear to be Caucasian.
Well, I look Caucasian, yeah.
And you identify as a Caucasian, correct?
I identify as Caucasian only because that has been, you know, what my family has done for us.
Oh. Okay. And that doesn't make a difference here on the Gist of Freedom. But I just wanted people to see just how, you know, throughout the years, how we can start off as African Americans and, you know, through some marriage and change the family structure to look like a rainbow.
Well, just that, Leslie. Look what happened to Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. You know?
Correct.
We start out with a white man and an African American lady, and we end up with, you know, as you say, a rainbow.
A rainbow. And I know that you guys got together, the Northup family. They had a family reunion, and it did look like a rainbow. Could you just tell the audience a little bit about your encounter, you know, your first encounter with the African-American Northups at this family reunion or this gathering for Solomon Northup?
Okay. I actually, before I even went to that, met up with a cousin of mine, and had just a little bit of a luncheon with her, and we sat and talked about, you know, different things because it was my first meeting with her. I am aware of the other side of our family, which actually comes from my grandfather's marriage to an African American woman. But anyways, in short, we sat, we met, we talked a little bit about, you know, different things, family related and some not family related, you know, and bringing ourselves up dating with both her family and mine. And going back to your main question, I found out about the Solomon Northup annual family event because I had never I attended way back in, I think, 1995, 96, when I found out, and my mom is actually the one who kept in contact with Aunt Victoria. And this particular group met at Sampson State Park out around Seneca Lake area, Geneva. And we all got together, and it was interesting to meet everyone and not know anyone. I did know of Aunt Victoria. I had seen her, talked to her, you know, sporadically throughout my life. I also, my father's siblings are technically African American. On their birth certificates, they're listed as Negro. And on some of the census, they are also listed as Negro, although they did pass. But going back to the Solomon Northup event, that year was 2013, 2 years ago. I had gone to a conference that was being held at Saratoga Springs by David Fisk, who was giving a seminar on Solomon Northup. He is a researcher and has done, you know, many, many, many papers that have been published, as well as having, I believe, 3 books now that he has either authored or co-authored. In talking to him, you know, I had, you know, been embraced and learned a lot more about, you know, the dynamics of some of the things that he had learned about our family history. And while there, I was approached by a lady who happened to be Renee Moore. Renee Moore is the founder of the Solomon Northup Day of Celebration, which is the annual event that's held there in Saratoga Springs. She has since turned over the wheels of that event to Skidmore College that chairs it now and has since last year. But I met up with her and, you know, we had a nice little conversation and she told me about, you know, one thing and another about, you know, the event that happens every year. And anyways, I had that incentive and, you know, that sort of push to make time and to actually attend. And when I did, I met up with, you know, a whole bunch of people. I think in that attendance, we had about 70 folks from both her side and my side of the family. And it was quite interesting because, you know, in some respect, we were all sort of guarded because, you know, you have your own, I don't know, thoughts about, you know, people that you don't know. You're sort of, you know, standoff, you push off, or however you want to say it. But in the long run, we all got together and we talked about different things and we met at a restaurant to have dinner after the event. And, you know, it was kind of neat to meet family that had been strangers. So wow. I'm saying that in the long run, we're all getting to know each other and it's still new. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're embracing some things and we're still, you know, talking about other things that, you know, are causing us issues. Like all families have, you know, different things to talk about. Some are not, you know, things we want to talk about, but they have to be in order to embrace each other a little bit more than what we have done in the past.
Okay. Now, before we go any further, we can't help but talk about the current event. And, you know, this is a very sad day for America and African Americans, specifically, especially we want to send our prayers out to South Carolinians.
Yes.
You have a unique perspective because before this story hit, where the 9 people were murdered in South Carolina at the historical church that was founded by Denmark Vesey, we also had a story that was in the news about a woman passing for black, Rachel Dolezal.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
I would like your unique perspective because here you are, visibly, you know, a Caucasian woman who is embracing your black heritage. You may be able to identify and explain why she would do something like identify with black people, even
well,
though
the only thing
her
I'm going
family
to say about, okay, the only thing I'm going to say about the Rachel Dolezal case is I don't want to jump on a bandwagon that is accusatory, and I don't want to be the one who says I'm accepting of it. I want all the information before I make a decision. I don't know what her background was. I don't know what her family life was like. I don't know what prompted her to do the things that she has done. But you know, there is a time and space because we here in America, we are at a pinnacle or near enough to a pinnacle that we are dealing with racial issues that are so intense, you know, that are almost like a keg of dynamite ready to explode. And there are so many things that not only the black folk have to look at and the white folk have to look at, but we need to find some common ground that we can work together because we have to do it for our children and our grandchildren. I get very emotional.
I can tell. And I can, and you're very sincere. Like I said, you've been on the show before, and I remember from the last interview your background, your family lineage, and how, you know, your background, how you developed and learned about your family lineage. So we will move on, and we will talk about.
Well, I get a lot of backlash. I get a lot of backlash, Leslie, because, you know, there are folks who assume things, and when they do, they make you very uncomfortable. And some of the things that, you know, my history has taught me is to be a little bit more hesitant in knowing more things and becoming a little bit more transparent. I understand there are those things. I understand that there are those things and those times that word transparency does not fit the situation. You know, and I know people are going to say you're full of baloney or whatever, but I'm up in I'm almost near my 80s, so I've got a lot of experience.
80 years old.
I'm almost
80. Almost.
I'm not going to say I'm knocking on that decade, but I'm almost.
And that's a blessing, right? You've seen a lot, learned a lot, and you're a wise woman. And
well, I don't know.
Well, I remember talking to you. Yeah, we've talked a lot on Facebook, and we've done interviews and pre-interviews, and I always enjoy talking to you and the insight that you give me from your perspective and your experience is incredible. So, you know, I enjoyed the last interview, and I know we're going to enjoy this one as well. But,
I know from being a kid growing up that, you know, and I think you've read my story, but when we left a lovely, cozy farm environment and we went out to the big city.
Florida, right?
Excuse me?
You moved to Florida, if I recall?
Right. We moved from Leedsport, New York. We went to a couple of places in the state of New York. And then we traveled the eastern seacoast down to Florida and ended up in Jacksonville. And that was, 1954-55. And we were looking at the civil rights era, you know, really stepping up in time, to say the least. And every time you turned around, there was always something in the newspaper about an African who had, you know, gotten killed, gotten hung. You know, and a whole bunch of crazy dynamics. And I'm just a kid. I was 10, 11 years old. Maybe younger. I don't remember. But I just have that image in my head. And I'm thinking, here we are almost, 60 years from then? And here we are with the same things going on. You know, has it changed? It hasn't changed to the point where we can all sit down and have a decent conversation. You know, everybody is in their own corner, and I don't see the flexibility. You know, I understand, believe me, the pain that African-American people feel. I know the pain that my father felt when he came home from service, and all he could do was talk about the way that he was treated as an African-American male in a white unit, you know. I know when he went out and worked, you know, there weren't a lot of jobs for people were, you know, of one particular race. It was an amalgam of a lot of folks. And he, being an African-American, was always the one pointed out to do the butt-wiping jobs. You know, it might be not good language, but that is basically what he did. He managed to work up and got to be a supervisor in construction. And, you know, fortunately for us, he was able to do a lot of traveling and work with some of the major companies. You know, he worked on the New York State Thruway. He worked at the Niagara Power Plant. You know, and help get those things built. And, you know, we see, you know, what they do for us today. And down
now
in Florida, and down in Florida, you know, he was treated as if he were the rug or the dirt swept under the rug. you know, and trashed on so much. And
wow.
When my mom and my dad and us kids used to go out together, you know, people would turn and call such nasty names that I never heard before. And, you know, there's everybody's heard them, so there's no sense of repeating that stuff. But
right.
Even today, kids are taught to say and do the same things. And here we
right.
are, how many generations?
Right. Well, I have to ask you, you know, when you learned about Solomon Northup, how did you, you know, how did that transfer, that information about Solomon Northup transfer to you and make you feel, knowing the history of your childhood, you know?
Solomon Northup was not new knowledge to me.
Mm-hmm.
Solomon Northup I knew about when I was a kid. My mother, bless her soul, was very open. I mean, she didn't hide things. And she knew that when she married my father that, you know, there was a little bit of disdain between her parents, who were, you know, French, Canadian, English, and Dutch. They weren't so happy, and Mom told me this, that they weren't happy because she had met, fallen in love, and married my dad. Well, you know, over time, I think they gradually cooled off and were more accepting and, you know, all that other, you know, stuff that you have to weigh and decide if you want family or if you want to be alienated. But my mother was the one who actually brought Solomon Northup to me and talked about it, and, you know, one thing and another. And a lot of that boiled over because when my grandmother passed away, at her funeral, there were people of both races there. And I didn't know, you know, the darker side of the family, if you will. I didn't know who those people were because they had not come to our house. We had not, you know, we had family picnics, but we never had our African-American side attend. And, you know, it was, to me, a new awakening. But my mother, as far as Solomon Northup is concerned, she is the one who introduced him to me. She spoke of the family history. I mean, she didn't make it, you know, totally out of proportion or anything like that. She just told me a little bit about what he had done, who he was, and the sacrifices that he had made, you know.
Okay, now, we can't go on any further in this interview without talking about Solomon Northup. Could you tell the audience who he is and about the film?
Oh, heavens. I hope everybody who's listening has seen that film by now. It came out in 2013. It was adapted by John Ridley from a book that my two times great grandfather had written in 1853. The book was printed by the Derby and Miller Company, a publishing company actually in Auburn, New York. And it did, I think there were about 30,000 copies of it that were over time put together, published, and sold. He did very well as far as, you know, selling that book. And actually it is considered a slave narrative, but in part it actually is different than most of the slave narratives that folks have, you know, have access to. I know here in the city where I live, that the main library downtown has a room, actually one floor, that's dedicated to the slave history, the Underground Railroad, and, you know, all of that period of time enrolled, and they have some of the older collections of books of the slave narratives. At any rate, Solomon's book is one that is set apart because he was very observant of the environment that he lived in. He almost had like a mind that was microscopic and picked up every single detail of the environment, of the people, of the trades that were going on, the sugarcane, the cotton and, you know, all of that stuff. And aside from that, he was very matter-of-fact about the people that were his owners. He never used words that were denigrating. He never really tore these people up and, you know, abused them and gave a full picture of what their life was like, what their personalities were. You know, he was very much into being, I think, more the detective, looking at things and being very objective. There were tools that were used that he was familiar with because his father, had a farm, and he learned to work and deal with very sort of tools that farmers used, and he actually brought an axe or built an axe that the southern plantation had not seen nor used in the past, and it was very productive in that when they went to chop trees and things like that, it was something that they had not seen before. I don't know how technology works from one part of the nation to another, but evidently that particular type of technology hadn't gone down south. He also, Solomon for himself, was very creative, more like an entrepreneur. He found ways to make himself busy, to create jobs, if you will. One of those was working on the Champlain Canal as a rafter because he there were a lot of lumber, I won't say mills around. What do you call those people? A lot of people who owned trees and needed them cut. And needed those cut trees to be taken to the lumber mills to be sawed and so forth. Well, he's the one who decided that he was going to go about and invent this task, this job, and built a raft and just took the logs down to the mill. So he had his own business for a while. He wasn't rich. He did marry. He did have three children. And he was, I think he was the person who had to be on the move all the time, who had to be doing something. And he met up with two men in Saratoga, and they kidnapped him at Washington, D.C., they encouraged him to come there only because they had a job for him. Solomon did play the violin. He was an excellent violinist. He did perform in the hotels and at different homes in Saratoga Springs and in that area. But because of his need for money, the promise by these two men was that he would receive $1 a day and $3 a week. Well, for him, that was a lot of money, considering he probably only made $1 a week. But their economy and everything like that was entirely different compared to what we have today. So, anyways, like I said, he did leave looking forward to this job. He thought it was only going to be like for a week, maybe 2 weeks. He did not tell his wife that he was leaving. And literally, he vanished off the map for a period of 12 years. By the time he got to Washington, he ended up in a jail, in chains. He was sold, spent his time in Louisiana and the Bayou, and, you know, had three different owners and was traded, you know, from here to there to there weren't jobs available down there on the plantations. There was a period where it was slacking off. He was traded from one plantation to the other to help out with that owner. And also with one of his plantation owners. He also, the owner himself owed money, so he sold Solomon to another individual who was not as polite.
Wow.
But in the long run, after 12 years, there was a letter that fortunately Solomon was able to get out of the Epps plantation to the people up north, to his wife. And thank goodness for these folks up north. They did put a petition together for him, and eventually he was rescued. He never escaped. He was rescued by the Henry family.
The movie did not really talk about how there were laws in place to rescue citizens, African-American citizens that were kidnapped. And his wife petitioned the governor with the help of some abolitionists, and they exercised their rights. Their laws were called the Liberty Laws, which were on the books.
Right.
And, you know, they spent a lot of time on the mistress or the new girlfriend on the plantation, and they really didn't give credit to his wife, who I consider to be like a Winnie Mandela for him. She was an advocate.
Well, the movie didn't even give credit to the lawyer. In fact, the movie didn't give credit to the time that it took for them to file the petition, to follow up with New York State, and then to come down again to Louisiana and go through that process too, because it wasn't an easy overnight, procedure. And you're talking about slave laws. There were slave laws that were specific, and they're called the Black Code or the Code Noir laws.
Right.
And those laws were instituted way back in the 1680s, 1660s. And they were written specifically by each state. Eventually, as the state, matured and they had, a whole host of slaves, these laws were written so that they were very restrictive as to what an African-American or an African slave could do, it was like, turning around and spitting in the wind. That's not on the law or on the books, but the thing was, they could not get married, they could not have their families, they could not go to church, they couldn't hold meetings.
And those laws are clear in almost every slave movie. But what I was upset about was that they didn't talk about the Liberty Laws and, like you said, the unity. They didn't show how the Underground Railroad really worked as far as freeing people and rescuing people through the use of intellect and the writings and petitions and how successful they were without, using a gun. Based on just working within the boundaries of the law.
Right, but that movie in itself, in the book, does not address the Underground Railroad.
No, but that's part...
Solomon doesn't talk about the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't make reference in the book about it. His affiliation with the Underground Railroad came after his rescue. Okay, because he did go around, after the book was published... He did go around to different, venues to basically talk about his events, about the book, to sell the book like everybody does today.
Right.
And in the process of going about to these different places, he met up with other abolitionists. He spoke with Frederick Douglass, in Syracuse, New York. That is documented. He may have met up with Harriet Tubman for all that I know. I'm not sure, if they had a face-to-face, but he was aware of her. And part of our history is connected to her indirectly because Frank Northrop married a great-great-grandniece of Harriet Tubman. They had no children, but still there is that, little tweak of a connection with her.
So, you know, we look at all things.
But
you did a
phenomenal job explaining the story. And now, as we close, could you tell the audience in our last 10 minutes about your call of action?
Okay, our call of action for, you know, all the work that has been done is a petition to honor Solomon Northrop with the Presidential Medal of Freedom honor. We have it out on Facebook. It is, I do believe you have it on your website as well, Leslie?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me? Okay.
Yes, I do. I have it.
It's there also is a memo that has gone through the White House. So hopefully, you know, I don't know if people can access that online or if it's just for, you know, the personnel there at the Capitol. I don't know how that worked. Actually, my niece was supposed to be calling in as well because she is the
one.
Okay,
what is your niece's name?
Melissa Howell.
All right, let's get on the line. Melissa,
yeah,
are you on the line?
Hi, Leslie.
How are you, Leslie?
Great. I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
Awesome. Your aunt is doing a phenomenal job, as I just mentioned. And now she's mentioned you.
Yeah.
Would you like to tell us more about this Medal of Honor?
Absolutely. Thank you. For those who are maybe just coming to the conversation or who have been here for the long term, I am the founding director of the Solomon Northrop Legacy. It is an organization I formed a year ago, January, in honor of our legacy and namesake, Solomon Northrop. And through the organization's many efforts and research projects, the Medal of Freedom petition came forth. And it is a very meritorious honor. It once was established as the Medal of Freedom for World War II veterans. And during John F. Kennedy's presidency, he enacted a revision of the award and had it renamed the Presidential Medal of Freedom, opening up the medal to those who are not only veterans but who contribute to other areas of security, national interest, world peace, and other cultural endeavors. And the award is open to citizens as well as foreign scholars. And with going back to research, a lot of education certainly has been the basis of discovering my heritage and learning of our extensive family of descendants, and also getting to know our ancestor by going into the field and retracing footsteps and drawing from those interpretive centers a sense of time, place, and person. And I found myself very overwhelmed, fulfilled in many ways in terms of a familial connection. And so with that, I had taken on some other projects, and this was inspired not only by the research that has been done and is ongoing, but also in the spirit of our ancestor. As we've, you know, heard a lot of conversation discussing cultural relevance and what is the significance of 12 Years a Slave and of Solomon Northrop's, you know, enslavement and How can we utilize the resurgence of his memoir and the film 12 Years a Slave, directed by Steve McQueen, and prior works of Film and Ethics Odyssey by Gordon Parks to help facilitate through conversation, realizing a timeline of the past, not forgetting the past, but perhaps have a better understanding and how we can move forward through forgiveness and acts of compassion and, time as we understand it to be, that it's not anything that can be forgotten. So I found that it was just out of his contribution through literature and through activism and a true sense of humility and integrity and character of a person who knew nothing but a life of freedom before he was kidnapped and certainly couldn't understand, a loss of, self-identification throughout that enslavement. And that in part, caused him some, duress. However, he rose from it. Very few were able to rise out of the soil and free of shackle and resume their lives. And I believe that is certainly a reminder of the person that he was in his community. His community found him to be a very upstanding individual. He was talented. He was skilled. And there was a great sense of bravery on his part. And for that, and more so because he took on the abolitionist movement for himself, helping others to freedom and engaging his community members to let them, sort of foray into, these discussions that they were already taking place about anti-slavery and sharing their ideas and their experience with one another to help perpetuate the collective, which was to, abolish slavery and find equality for all.
I hate to jump in here, but we're going to have to end the show in a few minutes. But how long do you think this process will take before you actually see this dream come true?
Okay. Well, there is no exact timeline that is known. However, the petition was launched on June 7th through the White House's portal, We the People. And the petition site exercises the number of signatures that are required. It has set a goal of 100,000 signatures by July 7th, and that is a few days short of Solomon's 208th birthday. And I'm hopeful. However, there is a second phase to the petition, which will be a formal recommendation that will be drafted and addressed to the president for his consideration of Solomon Northup for this incredible honor. It is the nation's highest honor for a citizen, which is the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And I do believe through research, it is very well possible that he will be the first slave to ever have been posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. I have only found through research one individual by the name of James U.B. Blake, who was awarded the Medal of Freedom, who was the son of slaves. So,
what do we have to do?
We need to rally the signatures via support. We certainly know that cultural relevance then and now, a 19th to the 21st century, is that we are still surrounded by the weaknesses of slavery in our society. That's a global concern. And we need people to go to the petition. We need them to go to justofreedom.com. If you have the link posted there, they can go to the Sol and the Northup Legacies Facebook page, where they can find a link as well. Sol and the Northup Legacies on Twitter, at Northup Legacy. We're on Instagram, Northup Legacy. And you can find us. You can find Solomon, because certainly Solomon Northup was a 19th century man.
And wow. It also is open, Leslie. It's an international drive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, okay. Of course. So. It is a collective effort. We can all be, as my aunt is parlaying into, you know, we are in the 21st century, certainly has relevance. There are Solomon Northups of today living in slavery. And as a collective group of abolitionists, we can all act. We can act by signing the petition and urging the president to consider this American hero. And I do not consider him lost. I consider him once again renounced and found and readily, you know, willing to speak through us. So I implore everyone who's listening to please sign that petition, because your voice counts. For those who cannot speak for themselves.
Oh, don't cry. You're so emotional. People, you hear how passionate our guest is. That is Irene, a Solomon Northup descendant. We're going to leave on this note. Irene, you will be back on with great news. We'll be celebrating when he receives that medal. And thank you very, very much.
It's such a pleasure.
All right.
Leslie.
God bless you, too. And you have a great evening and continue doing the great work.
Thank you much.
You as well.
You too. Uh-huh. You too. Thank you, Leslie.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.